I'll call House Judiciary Committee Subcommittee 1 to order. We have before us today on the agenda for public hearing Senate Bill 364 and SJR 18. And we lost counsel. Mr. Taylor, I would like to ask witnesses Lieutenant Erickson and Bonnie Griswold if you could come forward, and at the same time, counsel, if you could just describe these measures for us, just briefly. I understand the chairman will be joining us right away, and the other two members of the subcommittee are on the floor debating a bill that came out of this committee. So we will do our best to make this a continuous function on the committee's behalf. And everybody bear with us. Good afternoon. Counselor, could you just briefly describe the measures before us?
If I could do just 364 for now, because I
have okay.
to take a copy of them. The purpose and function of Senate Bill 364 is to expand the definition of pornography to include additional types of sexual conduct. That's found in Section 1 of the engrossed bill. Secondly, it removes the of-value element in the statute criminalizing the sale or exhibition of child pornography. Therefore, the bill criminalizes the transfer or trading of such materials in private transactions where no money is exchanged. That's in Section 5 and 10 of the bill. Thirdly, it raises the penalty for using children to produce child pornography from a Class B felony to a Class A felony. That's found in Section 3. 4, creates a new crime of transporting child pornography into Oregon as a Class B felony. That's found in Section 5. Under current law, it is illegal to buy or sell child pornography which has been produced in violation of Oregon law or which has been imported in violation of federal law. A person may also be prosecuted under existing federal law for transporting child pornography across state lines. 5, creates a new crime of failure to report child pornography as a Class A misdemeanor. 6, provides for forfeiture of materials, equipment, and vehicles used in the production or conveyance of child pornography. That's in Section 9. Eliminates expungement of crimes involving child pornography. That's in Section 7.
Now, as I understand, counsel, the accompanying SJR would amend the Oregon Constitution to conform with those statutory proposals. With that,
I think this is a result of Stephen Pfeiffer's here, but I believe this is a result of a recent Oregon Supreme Court case. Is that the Harris case? Henry case. Good.
Mr. Pfeiffer's signed up as a witness. So with that, Lieutenant Erickson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, I am Lieutenant Lee Erickson, Assistant Division Commander of the Criminal Division State Police. You have my prepared testimony. I won't read it. In brief, we have been involved in numerous pornography investigations through a task force that one of our members is involved with in the metro area. As a result of that task force, he has identified in excess of 100 individuals who are currently exchanging pornography of children as part of their sexual deviancy. Oregon law does not control this form of deviancy in that the exchange of child pornography without a fee or without consideration is currently not a violation of state law. Secondly, we have problems in enforcing the law if we can't prove that the pornography was produced in violation of Oregon state statutes. And in some cases, we can't prove that it was transported across state lines, which gives us a situation where we are unable to effectively enforce child victimization. We're relying on the element and the fact that a child must be victimized to produce child pornography. We have found, once again, in that deviancy cycle frequently includes child pornography in that cycle. That concludes my brief statements. I'd like to have you read the testimony, and I'll be free to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Phillips.
But Lee, on the investigation you've got going on, I assume since you're talking about it, there has either you can't, there's nothing else you can indict or pursue, or what's...
We have prosecutions underway at the federal level, which has laws to address this. There was an individual in the Sisters area who recently was arrested. We could not prosecute him under Oregon state law. He is being prosecuted federally. There was another case in Washington. The individual was victimizing or exchanging pornography with one of our officers across state lines. In fact, he brought the stuff into the state of Oregon across the bridge over into North Portland or Northeast Portland area, and we followed him and watched him transport it in, and then were able to arrest him on the fact that he transported it across. But we have to get so technical into that part of the law that it makes enforcement so cumbersome, and it doesn't provide the protection for the children who are the ultimate victims of this.
One other question.
Representative Phillips.
Does this bill generally follow the federal law then with regard to the transfer of material?
I'm not able to answer that.
Bill. Thank you.
We'll give a list of people who are...
Pardon me. Were there further questions for the representative from the Oregon State Police? Okay. If not, Ms. Griswold? Welcome.
I'm Bonnie Griswold, a probation officer supervising 40 sex offenders in the community. My experience includes 10 years as a caseworker for Children's Services Division, working with families and children. I am also a member of the Oregon Child Protection Task Force. These experiences have brought to light for me the ever-increasing problem of child exploitation and, of course, the aftermath effects of sexual abuse. I know that you are aware of the obvious effects of child exploitation. Child victims can suffer from fear, humiliation, anger, depression, and confusion. These feelings can be expressed in a variety of physical and emotional symptoms. Coupled with the added elements of photography or the use of child pornography, the problems of the victims are compounded. Children see the pictures as a permanent connection to the abusive situation, even if the actual physical event or events is completed. As you can imagine, the abuse can be continued in their minds as long as they know that the pictures exist. In all cases with which I have worked, these victims are fearful that others will see these pictures and that they, the victims, will be recognized. Even years later, these victims are afraid that the photographs will be uncovered. In an effort to gain more information and doing a little more research, I contacted a CSD worker in Washington County, and I was trying to get more information about the children in her group as regards the photography. And it turns out that these young children, regardless of their age, talk about the photographs and are very fearful. And this worker was at the time we were discussing whether we should bring a victim to testify, and she said that it wouldn't surprise her if we found no victims who were willing to testify. First of all, the abuse is so humiliating, but the idea that there is a record is extremely difficult for these children or adults to verbalize. In addition to that, I've also received a phone call from a young woman who was exploited about 10 years ago in California, and the man who offended her was one of my clients. She had asked me, once she found out that he was arrested, to go to the home and see if I couldn't recover those photographs. And when I explained that I was unable to do that, she was just totally devastated. She thought that I should be able to go out there and get these photographs. Even after 10 years, she is afraid that she'll be recognized. And, I mean, she was a child at the time that the pictures were taken. I didn't tell her that there was a strong likelihood that some of these photographs were given to other pedophiles as gifts or traded for other photographs of victims. These offenders share the pictures freely, and they do not expect anything in value in return for the pictures. The photographs are a history of an abuse and evidence of a crime. A picture of this nature cannot be taken without a child being sexually exploited. Offenders use these photographs repeatedly. They recall to the offender the abusive event. It feeds their deviant fantasies and their distorted thinking. This use becomes further abuse of the victim. The photographs are the grossest example of the offender's thinking and his activity. The child victim is no longer a human being to the offender. They become objects to be used and abused by the offender. I've seen pictures of victims from the ages of a few months to late adolescence, boys as well as girls. The victims may be related to the offender, or the victim may know the offender as a family acquaintance, friend, or neighbor. Whatever the circumstances, the offender is able to groom the victim and set up the situation where an offense takes place. Over the past 3 years, I have learned that sex offenders do use sexually explicit material in their offending cycle. Child molesters, especially those who are pedophiles, are very likely to keep photographic histories of the individual victims as well as the individual events of abuse to a victim. Their collection of material will also include commercially made magazines, newspapers, and videos. They may also make their own material by combining sexually explicit material with pictures of their victims or pictures of children they know or have cut out of commercial publications. And I have one man on my caseload right now who combines pictures of his victims and then sexually explicit material so that he makes his own child pornography. In addition to that, many times people are under the mistaken impression that an offender will only have one child that he will offend. This man recently reported to me after I, after we had an incest management team, which we use in managing our sex offender cases, that he came forward with a list of 40 children from the ages of 6 months to just under 18 years of age. And those children, he remembered over many years, and by their age and by their first name and where they were abused. So they're very meticulous about keeping these lists. With the passage of 364 and SJR 18, Oregonians will be better able to protect their children. Children of all ages and backgrounds can be exploited. They need your protection. Failing to pass these measures can only result in further victimization of our children.
Thank you, Ms. Griswold. Representative Hanlon.
And I've asked this question before. I didn't get a very good answer. This is about a year back. Representative Mary Alice Ford and I were touring St. Mary's Home for Boys, located in Washington County. And they have a sexual offender treatment program there. And they have treatment that involves connecting some...
The plethysmograph and the photo...
Yeah. And a mask that... At least it was on test then, that shoots them with ammonia when they get improper stimuli. But my question, and I'm offended by this stuff, my question relates to where they show child pornography to the boys on this program and then give them a whiff of ammonia to tell them that's wrong. But my question is, I didn't get an answer there. Where do they get those materials, even for that purpose? And are they acquiring those materials in a legal manner? And the question is for either one of you. What's the chain? How do those things get produced?
Well, I'll tell you, where most of the material that comes into Oregon that's used in the therapeutic setting came from a collection of 10,000 pictures that were taken of children being sexually exploited in the state of New York. And that man was arrested, and that material came through and was brought to the sex offender unit at Oregon State Prison, and they've used that. That's the material that they use in the aversive technique. Other than the chain of where it comes from, many, I think that there, of course, are there commercial publications that people can mail for or that they can exchange, you know, just one-to-one. But also, we have clientele that take pictures of their own children, take pictures of neighborhood children, and then they give these pictures to other people. And what was really interesting, I was at a task force meeting a couple of months ago, and we were looking at some pictures that had been taken of some children, and we're later looking at a film that one of our offenders had made, and we saw that two of the children in the film were actually the two children that were in the magazine. So they pass those freely, they mail them, they take stills off of movies, and that sort of thing. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Were there further questions from Ms. Griswold? Any further comments you folks wanted to make? Okay. If not, thank you again very much. Appreciate it. Steve Pfeiffer and Keith Meisenheimer, would you gentlemen like to come up together?
Senator.
Sarah Simmons, anytime you wish to join these folks, I intend to call upon you next, if that would be okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Pfeiffer, Assistant Attorney General and Chief Criminal Appellate Attorney in the Department of Justice. I have been a prosecutor, I suppose, since 1975. I worked for 6 years as a prosecutor in the Multnomah County DA's office. Representative Springer was there at that time, I believe, part of that time.
Boot camp.
And I've been involved in appellate work now since January of 1981, and have done cases involving sex offenses involving children. And I was the losing attorney in State versus Henry, in which the Oregon Supreme Court struck down the statute against disseminating obscene material. I want to first address the need for Senate Bill 364. It's the opinion of most prosecutors in this state that I've talked to, and people within the Department of Justice, that the present statutes, especially 163.675 and 163.680, are unworkable. And also they are, for all practical purposes, useless in combating the free exchange of child pornography in this state. Since I began working on this subject early in the session, I've had the opportunity to review statutes in other states. And I think it's a fair statement that Oregon's present statutes are among the weakest in the country. There are a number of states which are in the forefront of combating child pornography, Illinois and Ohio and Washington State come to mind, but the general tenor in this country among the states is to tighten up very severely on the problem of child pornography. Our current statutes that I referred to are a result of compromise that occurred towards the end of the last legislative session. There was a relatively strong bill that was watered down significantly in the last days of the session, and as a result, we have the current law. The problems, as we see it, with those statutes are two. First of all, the state has to prove where the item was made, either in Oregon or made somewhere else and brought into the state in violation of federal law. It's an either-or situation. You can't just throw it up and say it must be one or the other. You have to prove one of those. Now, photographs of this nature are not stamped made in Oregon or made in California. It just doesn't happen that way. It's virtually impossible to prove in most cases, absent admissions by the participants, by the defendants, that this material was made in Oregon or in some other state and brought in violation of the law. Secondly, there is the problem of the value element. As Ms. Griswold mentioned, I think it's fair to say that most child pornography in Oregon is exchanged freely among pedophiles without the exchange of money or something else of value. This is not the type of thing that's sold in adult bookstores. It's sold privately among pedophiles, and these people freely exchange it among themselves. They don't want money. They're using it as a means of boasting of their achievements and not seeking any type of financial gain. And so that value element is a significant burden in prosecuting these cases. It is true that district attorneys have not been able to bring cases under this statute because of these problems. That's why in this, you will not find any history or any test cases involving this statute. The statute's never been tested in the courts in 2 years because a district attorney, frankly, cannot bring a prosecution. I was disturbed to read in the Oregonian in an editorial that accused the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office somehow of misrepresenting the case in favor of this bill because they hadn't brought any of these cases and therefore they hadn't tested it in the courts. The fact is that a prosecutor can't bring a case under this statute unless he or she has the proof to begin with, and the proof simply isn't there as far as we can tell it. Next question is Senate Bill 364 constitutional? The pure possession element in this bill has been taken out. It was taken out in Senate Judiciary, and so that removes any possible federal claim under the case of Stanley versus Georgia that somehow possession of child pornography is protected by the U.S. Constitution. The next question is, and if you take out the possession problem, I think that there's no doubt in my mind that this bill is constitutional under current federal law. Next question is it constitutional under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution? This is more difficult after State versus Henry. Under a very broad reading of State versus Henry, where you have such language as, quote, in this state, any person can write, print, read, say, show, or sell anything to a consenting adult, even though that expression may be generally or universally considered obscene, unquote. If you read that as broadly as you can, then perhaps some court could say that also applies to child pornography. I don't believe that the Oregon Supreme Court would go that far as to say that child pornography is as protected as so-called adult pornography is. In fact, we believe that the Oregon Supreme Court would have decided Henry differently had it been confronted with child pornography and the need to protect children. The reason I say that is that the exception is built into the Henry case itself. They said that there was no historical exception for adult pornography, a regular obscenity, if you will, in the Henry case, because the exception that the state relied upon depended upon corruption of minors. And they said that as long as it's kept out of the hands of minors, then adults can possess and exchange this material freely. But if the basis for the legislation is the protection of children, then I think you do have that historical exception, and it would be defensible under Article 1, Section 8. Now, there's a surefire way to avoid any possible constitutional problem in Senate Bill 364 under the Oregon Constitution, and that is to pass Senate Joint Resolution 18, which amends Article 1, Section 8. And so we would urge that those two bills be treated as companion measures to ensure that there would not be any constitutional problem with Senate Bill 364. That's all I have, unless there are questions.
Okay. Representative Phillips.
Yeah, just looking through the bill and comparing it to the statute, trying to figure out, there's a couple of words that I need you to, just for anything else, perhaps legislative record. What does sexually explicit, what's the word explicit mean?
Explicit, the way I take that term means that you can see it.
Well, is it defined by case law? I mean, we're not going to have a debate over what's explicit and what's not explicit.
I don't think so. I think you'll find case law defining that term.
Okay. And how about the purposes of sexual stimulation?
Yes. The purpose of that language is to take bathtub pictures of naked children that all parents have, take those out of this prohibition entirely. If I had some of these pictures, I could demonstrate what I'm talking about. These pictures that just show children, usually without their heads even in the picture, are obviously posed for purposes of sexual stimulation. And of course, the state would have to prove that through the nature of the item itself, through circumstantial evidence. You can infer from that what the purpose is. It's not unlike the statute against the public indecency, where you have to prove that the exposition of the genitals was for purposes of sexual gratification.
Okay, just one other.
Phillips.
Do you get any problem when you say for purposes of sexual stimulation? And I guess you'd have to rely on a common sense definition of what is and what's in it, isn't there. But then when you add the words of the viewer, and what I mean, it sounds so obvious to somebody for the viewer, but what if you were to arrest somebody on a totally different charge and you find them in possession of sexually explicit material that they're transporting back and forth, which now we've got a problem with. And are those words really necessary? You know, I mean, is that... I'm trying to figure out exactly what you're getting
at. The words of the viewer?
Yeah. I mean, if the
I'll tell you why I think that it's necessary. There's a case I argued, State versus House, which involved nude male dancing in Washington County. And the court stated in that case that it couldn't tell for sure whether the sexual stimulation had to be on the part of the dancer or on the part of the viewer. And so they interpreted it to mean that the dancer had to be doing it for purposes of stimulation. And so what this does is make clear that the person who's transporting this stuff doesn't have to be interested in child pornography himself or herself. It's meant for the ultimate recipient, the one who views it.
Okay. Well, that was my point. I wanted to make sure that that language wasn't so limiting that we couldn't get the transporter of the information.
No, I think it's meant for the ultimate person who views the material.
Excuse me. We're under a call to the House, so I'm going to have to ask folks to excuse us. I hope for just a few minutes. We'll be in recess. We've got several other folks, and believe me, we're going to do everything we can to make sure everyone gets a chance to testify. Gentlemen, I think there may be a few more questions for you, and then we want to hear from Senator Simmons. We know, Senator Simmons, you've got if there's anything we can do to accommodate your schedule, please let us know. If there are any other folks who have a particularly tight timeline, please just let our staff know in our absence, and we'll try to accommodate your schedule to every extent we can. We'll be in recess for purposes of call. Please. Thanks again for your patience. For the record, Group Sam Hanlon and I are present. We don't have a quorum, but for purposes of continuing public testimony, we have sufficient members. We hope to be joined here in just a few moments by our colleagues. And I believe at the time we took a recess, we were taking some testimony from Mr. Pfeiffer. And if you'd like to go ahead and continue, please do so.
I was finished with my testimony. I'm capable of answering any questions if you have any.
Okay, counsel.
Stephen, we talked during the recess, and I'd like to direct your attention to Section 9 of the bill on page 4. It says it's unlawful for any person to observe sexually explicit conduct by a child known by the person to be under 18 years of age, or to obtain or view a photograph or other visual recording of sexual conduct by a child under the 18 years of age, period. Mm-hmm. I take it that visual recording would not include a painting or a sketch.
No, this bill is limited to photographs and videotapes and movies. And
okay. You mentioned early in your testimony that possession was removed from the bill. I think...
Mere possession is.
Mere possession. An attempt to not run afoul of the Stanley v. Georgia, am I correct?
Well, I don't know if that was the purpose of taking it out. There may have been other reasons beyond constitutional ones, but that what I stated was that takes out that potential problem. Mm-hmm. Or that challenge under Stanley versus Georgia, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, aren't we talking in this section of possession, really?
Let me answer it this way. A defendant charged under this section would certainly challenge it under the same reasoning that Stanley versus Georgia would apply, and that it's simply an aspect of possessing to view it. But it's not the same thing as possession. Possession means that you have to have dominion and control over something.
Sure. And if there's a problem, assuming there's a problem with possession, would there obviously be even more of a problem with something less than possession?
Well, my testimony in the Senate was, and it continues to be, that there is not a problem with possession. A problem by which our position is that the U.S. Supreme Court would not follow Stanley versus Georgia in the context of child pornography. They've made that clear in New York versus Ferber, that child pornography is treated differently from adult pornography.
Mm-hmm. I agree in that. Could you give me an example of what would be considered a violation of Section 9 to observe sexually explicit conduct, to obtain or view a photograph? Now, we talked about some examples in the corridor, and we talked about mens rea or mental state of mind. Could you give me some examples of what you would consider to be a violation of the section of viewing or observing?
If in the hallway I were to have material that would come under the definitions as applied in this bill, and I were to give it to someone, suppose they completely, for the first time, had seen this material, and instead of giving it back, or instead of turning away, or instead of calling the police, or whatever, they were to take it and look at it themselves over in the corner, and obviously look at it intentionally or knowingly, and that would be a violation of the of Section 9. If, on the other hand, they were to turn away or to just view it inadvertently, without any criminal intent or knowledge.
Debate in the Senate was about 2 hours. We've transcribed testimony of the floor debate there. It takes up 42 pages of typewritten testimony or speeches. It was controversial there, and no doubt it will be controversial here too. But I do believe that it's an issue that is very important, not only to the state, but to the communities at large. I don't know if you're going to have testimony from anyone from the federal agencies here, but it's unfortunate that much of the prosecution that goes on in the state goes on through U.S. Customs and through the federal statutes and through federal courts, because the Oregon courts and our current constitutional language as it's interpreted by the Supreme Court preclude an aggressive enforcement policy in this area. I want to give you, or at least read to you, I don't know if you have copies of this either, but it's an organization in Texas, Citizens for Decency Through Law, which was sent a copy of SJR 18 earlier, and in essence their legal counsel, Benjamin Bull, sent a letter back that said that I have reviewed SJR 18 and support it completely. The amendment adopts the United States Supreme Court definition that has subsequently been restricted. But it goes on to say that the fact that Oregon presently has no control over obscenity and child pornography acts as a magnet for pornographers from all over the world. They will and are flocking to Oregon in droves because it is now a wide open state. Without SJR 18, Oregon will become the Amsterdam of the United States. It also goes on to say that Amsterdam leads Europe in AIDS, teenage pregnancy, and prostitution, child pornography, and obscenity. Without the amendment, you're giving up your right to raise your children in a decent society, and I support the amendment completely. I want to go on to say that one of the members of the committee, who I believe is going to have some questions here, asked me to what degree should government, particularly law enforcement agencies, be involved in regulating the private activities, particularly the private sexual activities of adults. And my comment in response to that was that when we have a situation where children are the object of sexual behavior and they are the victims of that behavior, and subsequently those pictures are all reproduced, sold, and transported throughout the state, traded throughout the state, to me, the rights of the individual child who's depicted in that picture and that activity, that child, to me, has a greater right to not have those pictures disseminated than does the individual who holds those pictures and subsequently reproduces and sends them out. My experience as a law enforcement officer, I'm going to relate an experience to you where I was called to a house, and there was a lady who was breaking up from her husband. She was very upset because she had the opportunity at that time to allow us to search a home, the home that she had lived in prior to separating from her husband, to find some materials. And she was very adamant about the fact she wanted these materials. And what they were some pictures of her involved in some sexual behavior with some other men at the request of her husband. And I remember very vividly, even now, the frantic attitude that this lady had in that she wanted those pictures. Because as she was separating from her husband, she knew that those pictures still existed. And as long as those pictures still existed and there was the ability to disseminate or to trade those pictures or to give them away, that it was her life that was being given and traded and depicted in those pictures, even though she was ashamed of that particular behavior. We were able to find the pictures and give them to that woman, and she subsequently destroyed them. And I can't recall a woman who was more relieved because of that. So when we're talking about child pornography, I think that the young people that are being depicted, real live human beings who are involved in these pictures, they're not adults. They're children who've been lured into an activity that, if they were an adult making a conscious decision to do what they're doing, I don't believe them as a rational adult would make the decision to find themselves involved in that behavior. I think you are well aware of the problems related to sexual abuse and crime and subsequent involvement in drug abuse and abuse of children and ad infinitum on and on. That is why I feel that it's an important issue. And if you have any questions, I would be glad to try and respond to you.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Minnis? Representative Phillips.
John, we often hear statistics that many of the individuals that commit sexual deviant crimes were victims themselves. Have you developed any statistics to confirm that or any information?
Representative Phillips and Mr. Chair, Representative Phillips, I don't have any specific statistics that I can give you. I can relate that in my some 12 years of law enforcement experience and my training at Portland State University in criminal justice has given me at least one of the better examples of an individual who today is walking around the state of Oregon. And if he was here today, because I know him well enough, he would be here and would probably testify the same thing that I'm going to say. He was one of the Oregon State Penitentiary's model prisoners, went to Portland State University to get a criminal justice degree, and his major emphasis while doing that was that he wanted to become a probation parole officer and couldn't see a reason why a convicted felon should not be. And I remember one time we were socializing together. He at that time had spent 23 years in the penitentiary. I'm a young person looking at a law enforcement career. He told me that his goal in life was to have two white women and a Cadillac. That was his goal, his major goal. And he went on to explain to me that he grew up in the Los Angeles area, the child of a prostitute, a trick baby, and that has carried on throughout his life to the point that his sole objective was to have two white women working the street in a Cadillac. Prior to graduating from college, where he was very close to that goal, and by the way, this fellow is very charismatic. If I named his name, you would probably know who he is. He subsequently ended up breaking into a co-ed's apartment and beating her and raping her, and then was sent back to prison. A little over a year ago, he was on Oregon's 10 most wanted list. When we came into this legislative session, I found him wandering down the halls and gave me a card, and he's lobbying for some art firm, you know. So all I can say is that's one of the greatest examples. But I have seen time after time after time in my contact with people, drug addicts, prostitutes on the street, that they have come from lifestyles that are very similar to the lifestyles that they're involved in. The criminals that I have arrested, I mean, we could go on hours and hours and hours. The stories are endless. There's a very definite connection.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, you expressed a concern to me, and I don't know if Steve Pfeiffer is still here, but we may want to clarify that issue.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might just comment that I had a question on some wording on the bill, and as Mr. Pfeiffer left, I tried to catch him in the hall. He and I did not agree, but I agreed to call him later and talk with him about the issue.
All right, thank you.
Further questions or comments for 10 minutes?
Mr. Chairman, in closing, I only have one comment, and that is, again, two comments. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this again. And, Mr. Chairman, if you would, I would like to ask you to respectfully ask you to state your intentions as far as a work session on this particular bill or these two bills are concerned.
Okay. If there are no further questions, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have first person other than those who we've heard from at this time to sign up was Mr. Van Valkenburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Walter Van Valkenburg, I'm an attorney from Portland, and I'm a member of the board of directors of the ACLU. I'm here to speak briefly in opposition to both of the bills you're considering this afternoon. It's a little difficult to speak in opposition to bills that are designed to get at a problem as serious as the problem that's been described here this afternoon. Certainly neither I nor the ACLU favor restricting the ability of law enforcement agencies to pursue child abuse. The ACLU does not oppose restrictions on the sale of child pornography. We do oppose these bills, though, for one basic reason. The process involved here is not the appropriate way to address the problems that have been described to you this afternoon. Taking the constitutional amendment first, you've heard various statements of opinion as to whether or not Oregon can prosecute sale of child pornography under the Supreme Court's opinion in State versus Henry. I agree with Mr. Pfeiffer and with several other people who have testified that State versus Henry does not prevent the state of Oregon from prosecuting the sale of child pornography. If you look at the opinion, the Supreme Court specifically mentions the fact that it's not dealing with a case involving child pornography. And as Mr. Pfeiffer pointed out, the opinion, the reasoning behind the opinion indicates that child pornography could and probably would be treated differently under the Oregon State Constitution than obscenity, generally defined, which was what was at issue in Henry. Therefore, this provision, SJR 18, to refer a constitutional amendment to the voters is unnecessary. It's also dangerous, in our view. Constitutional provisions are supposed to be phrased in terms of general principles. They're different than statutes. The proposed amendment to Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution treats Article 1, Section 8 like a statute. We have a general principle that laws should not be passed restricting expression, but we have one particular area that we don't want that general principle to apply to. It's unnecessary in this case to create a specific exception of the Constitution, and it's dangerous because the next thing that occurs is there will be another problem area that we want to address by a specific exception to the Constitution, and so forth and so on. So I'd urge you to vote against referring the proposed constitutional amendment to the voters. The statutory amendment is a little more difficult to deal with because it's much more complicated. There are several problems, though, that have been pointed out, and your counsel, Mr. Taylor, I think addressed some of them a few minutes ago. The question of whether or not this proposed amendment to Oregon's child pornography legislation is constitutional under the federal constitution, I think, is a serious question. The prohibition on viewing of child pornography, as Mr. Taylor pointed out, is tantamount to a prohibition on possession. One witness testified that child pornography is treated differently under the federal constitution than obscenity generally is. That's correct, but the Stanley versus Georgia case that's been referred to this afternoon is not based only on the First Amendment. It's also based on a concept of privacy, the notion that the state cannot make criminal the mere possession of expression in one's home. This bill would make criminal the possession of expression in one's home by making it illegal to view one particular form of expression. The bill would also prohibit the transfer, the exchange, other than for value, of child pornography. I'm not quite sure whether or not as strong an argument can be made against that as the prohibition on viewing under the federal constitution, but that too would raise federal constitutional problems. If two people living together exchange what's prohibited by the bill, literally the bill would cover that. The point I'm trying to make is not that an effective child pornography bill aimed primarily at sale could not be drafted. The point I'm trying to make is that this bill is not that bill. This is not a well-drafted bill. It contains a number of difficulties, and although I have not been involved in the process to the extent you all have, and I haven't heard all of the testimony that you've heard throughout the session, I do think that the prudent course here would be to undertake the sort of study that's been suggested to determine the kinds of problems law enforcement personnel are experiencing under the current law, to try and investigate some of the opinions that have been expressed about how
child pornography contributes to some of the problems that have been described, and rather than to enact a bill in the closing days of the session that contains as many flaws as this bill does, to try and come up with a reasoned and relatively thorough study of the problem that can be presented to the legislature for appropriate action involving, along the way, people who represent various differing interests and who are in a position to provide you with the kind of empirical evidence I think you should demand before you enact a bill that touches on expression as closely as this one and creates as many constitutional questions as this one does. I could go on, but I know it's running on into the afternoon. I'd be glad to answer any questions if anyone has any.
We appreciate your concise statement. Representative Phillips?
Your testimony raises a couple of questions. One, we study things to death, though offering another study, I'm not sure, is a good alternative. You say there's problems with the bill. Tell me what's socially redeeming or has any value whatsoever in the transporting of clearly pornographic information. And if you need an example, I think Senator Simmons still has the pictures there. Why should we not make that illegal?
If you could limit, you're talking about transporting it across state lines or transporting from one.
Possessing it, having it. What's the value of that existing?
My opinion is that there is no value in the mere possession of child pornography defined as some of the child pornography has been defined this afternoon. The difficulty is, first of all, drafting a statute that limits itself to that kind of pornography that's been described. And I think more importantly, the difficulty that the United States Supreme Court saw in Stanley versus Georgia of allowing the state to come into people's homes and investigate, obtain search warrants to prosecute crimes that are based solely on possession of expressive materials in the home. I think that's the primary problem. If you could get around that, the actual possession, I'm not prepared to argue that there is a lot of socially redeeming value in the kinds of depictions that have been described this afternoon.
One more, Mr. Chair, or another one.
Representative Phillips.
Okay. You predict this theory of somebody going into the home, they'd have to have a search warrant, which means they have to go to some authority and state their case as to why they want to go in and search. They find these sexually explicit material, let's say photographs, and again I'll refer you to Senator Simmons' material. Obviously, to possess those pictures, I believe, is wrong, personally. But beyond my personal beliefs, somebody was victimized even to take those pictures. And Dan, that's the point. Now, why shouldn't we be able to get at those folks that even possess those? Because even if they possess them, somewhere in the trail of this process, somebody was victimized, and you can't even begin to express the damage that might have been done.
Well, I think that argument could be made with respect to just about every constitutional provision that restricts the ability of law enforcement agencies to effectively right injustices and remedy victimization. I mean, I agree with you. It would be nice if we could do that without trampling on other values. But I think what the Supreme Court is saying in the Stanley case is that we need to cut that off with respect to possession in the home.
Well, I guess another question.
Representative Phillips.
Okay, tell me what rights we're trampling on of people if the courts go through, the law enforcement goes through, gets the search warrant, goes in, and finds somebody with this material. What rights are we trampling on when we go into their home?
The right to privacy in one's home.
And the right to privacy supersedes the victimization of these children or young adults or whomever there might be.
No, it's not a question of superseding. It's a question of trying to balance different rights, trying to address competing interests. It's the same problem that we have when we restrict the ability of the police to search without a warrant, even though somebody's been victimized by a crime.
Well, I'm saying they've got a warrant, and they went through the right process, the legal the process that is required, and they found or they've arrested somebody for whatever reason, and in their possession they have this material. And you're saying it's not an issue of superseding, but it's an issue of balance. Now, well, what's the balance? I mean, the balance is the victim, child, or individual versus
what? I mean, there's got to be a societal benefit here. And I see no societal benefit in child pornography. None whatsoever, right? I've never heard anybody suggest that there's anything there. In fact, there's well documentation that even existing of it, it shows a pattern of other problems that are out there.
You made the point earlier that you can study things to death, and I'm sure that's true. I doubt that passing this bill is going to solve the kinds of victimization or even really seriously address the kinds of victimizations you're getting at. But I think the point is that the process that's occurring here is not the process that you want to rely on in order to pass a bill like this. I think it deserves study. If we can substantiate some of the points you're making, it may be that a bill that contains some of these provisions would be appropriate. All I can tell you is I don't think that that substantiation has been made, and I don't think this is a good bill.
Well, I think we have different points of view on this one, so
I'm sure we do.
It would appear so. Further questions for Mr. Van Valkenburg? Comment? If not, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. I've got Craig DeMoe.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Craig DeMoe, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Evangelicals and Greater Portland Association of Evangelicals. Just for a point of reference, the Oregon Association comprises about 1,600 local churches with memberships estimated between 250,000 and 300,000 all across the state of Oregon. We have a moral imperative to speak out in support of Senate Joint Resolution 18, which I came prepared to do today, but I didn't realize we'd also be dealing with Senate Bill 364. And of course, you can see that some of my comments could be directed toward that measure as well. Unlike some of the current rhetoric, this measure will not tear the Bill of Rights asunder. It will not trample on other rights, as it's been said before, nor limit the rights of free speech and free press, unless one considers child abuse for the production of pornography to be legitimate expression. Neither is it a hastily conceived measure. Again, I would remind us of all the professionals that have spoken to the need for this language. And an interim study will not turn up anything substantially new. At stake is the protection of citizens in every community, and policies for this purpose which are best decided upon at the local level, not by the Oregon Supreme Court. Our chief concern is the protection of innocent children. The illegitimate pornography industry does not simply involve those adults who publish it and those adults who perversely feed on it, but it involves countless minors who have been abducted, abused, and murdered for its production. This is pornography at its very worst. At its best, it ends up in the hands of children to pollute their minds, their values, and productive capabilities, and may lead their parents or potential parents into destructive thought patterns that destroy the family. None of us can ignore also the countless reports of violent crimes perpetrated at the suggestions of pornographic literature. I'm not describing a victimless crime. At issue is whether it is more important to protect the desires of a few for a perverted, hedonistic pleasure, or to protect our children. SJR 18 does not allow pornography. But without this added language to our Constitution, no Oregon community can set their own standards. SJR 18 does not impose the will of a few on the entire state, but allows us all to decide at the ballot box, weighing the so-called limitation of individual liberty against the good of the state, the restoration of community autonomy, and the protection of our posterity. As strongly as we believe in individual liberty, and we do, we affirm that there are instances when the protection of people compels the restriction of others. My rights end where the lives of others begin. No one has the right to abuse children. While those who produce and or defend obscene material talk about the importance of civil liberty, Their track record proves they do not care about the lives of others. It must be remembered how child pornography is used, and we've heard about that today. What is the role of government? We say it is not simply to affirm freedom, but also to protect the citizenry. Free speech is important, but the current interpretation of Article 1, Section 8 of Oregon's Constitution is nothing more than an invitation to pedophiles to come to this state. If that were not true, incidentally, we wouldn't even be talking about a constitutional problem. Whose interests will be served by opening Oregon's doors to the purveyors of any and all kinds of obscenity? It certainly will not be the common interests of Oregonians. I implore this committee, in the name of that common interest, to swiftly send SJR 18 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We've got your statement, of course, which is part of the record. Were there any questions for Mr. DeMoe? Excuse me, Representative Dix.
This is somewhat off the subject. So if someone has something relating directly to the testimony, perhaps they'd want to talk.
Representative Phillips.
Greg, your comments are broad enough to apply to Senate Bill 364. Am I correct in assuming that you would wholeheartedly endorse that measure also?
Yes, I do.
Okay. You've implied, and I don't dispute this, that if we don't do anything, we'll be the haven for this nationally. Wouldn't you agree, however, that even making statutory changes would dispel that sort of magnet effect that you've sort of set up?
Well, certainly that's going to help, but the question keeps being raised, is 364 going to be held up in the absence of SJR 18?
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Dix.
I was just curious, Greg, you mentioned the pornography leading to violent crime, and it seems that, and this is somewhat aside from the issue at hand, but I was just curious your thoughts. That, for instance, Elizabeth Downs, who has been convicted of murder and attempted murder from my home county, was an incest victim when she was a child. What do we end up doing with people that turn to violent crimes when their childhood really directly led them to prison? In that particular case, or any really, I can give you an example. After Gary Gilmore, who was executed in Utah, was a victim of child abuse for about 13 years of his childhood. I just was curious if you had any thoughts on that as well.
Well, I don't know. No, I had not come prepared to deal with that question. It's one that I find hard to deal with, to be quite frank, because what I hear you saying is it's almost in a sense someone else's fault that they have this criminal behavior that manifested itself toward these children or other people. I suppose when we look at the individual, that's a tough question. When we look at society as a whole, I suppose they should be dealt with under current statute that would apply to their criminal behavior.
I guess the reason why I bring it up is if one of the measures isn't passed out, I guess you could suggest that we as a society haven't taken the proper steps to protect those children. Many times those children, if they survive, end up being the violent criminals of tomorrow due to their childhood, because we have let them down, or society, if you will, hasn't taken the necessary steps to protect them from the violent behavior which has imposed itself on them in an age where they can't do anything about it, really shape their psyche. It's just,
well, I think you said it very well, and I concur with that.
Okay, any further questions from Mr. DeMoe? If not, thanks very much, Greg. Christine Rinaldi. And I believe, Ms. Rinaldi, you've signed up on both. Please feel free to address both, of course, here.
Well, I'm not used to this, so I just hope I'm appropriate, and I want to thank you for letting me speak with you. And I appreciate it. I am, my name is Christine Rinaldi, and I am here on behalf of Sandra Nelson, who is ill, but has submitted a testimony on behalf of Concerned Women for America. And I will read portions of this testimony. I am speaking on behalf of the 13,000 Oregonian Concerned Women for America, who urge you to support Senate Joint Resolution 18. As concerned Women for America, we are unequivocally opposed to pornography and obscenity because of their detrimental effects on children, women and men, marriage and families. Pornography is a direct attack on significant relationships. Pornography's message is that human beings are only sexual objects to be used for one's own sexual gratification, apart from love, commitment, morality, and responsibility. The Concerned Women for America uphold the United States Constitution's First Amendment right to freedom of speech, but we also agree with the United States Supreme Court that there are limits to every freedom. In a publication of the Center for Judicial Studies, Rice